Thousands of years have gone by since Adam and Eve's first sin, when God gave them a promise of a Savior who would win. Words from the Baby King, Concordia Publishing House's new Christmas arch book. The Baby King would make a great Christmas gift for children, grandchildren, and godchildren ages 5 through 9. Browse before you buy at issuesetc.org or call 1-800-325-3040. The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for December, The Baby King.
They've attacked my wife. They've attacked the foundation we started. They've attacked my judicial decisions. They've attacked my property taxes. They've attacked everything I know. And most recently, my character.
By any objective standard or review that examines the extensive corroboration of the statements of these women and significantly the inconsistencies of Roy Moore's denials, it is crystal clear that these women are telling the truth and Roy Moore is not.
The president feels that he would rather have a person that supports his agenda versus somebody who opposes his agenda every step of the way. And until the rest of that process plays out, you have a choice between two individuals, and the president's chosen to support Moore.
That's Alabama Republican Senate candidate Roy Moore, his opponent Doug Jones, and White House Press Secretary Sarah Sanders reacting to the sexual assault allegations against Moore. Well, in 2016, we had a massive lesson in voting for the lesser of two evils. You remember that? It was during the presidential campaign, or not voting for the lesser of two evils. And now the issue's been raised again with respect to that Alabama Senate seat. You have someone who is, well, someone who is the biggest proponent of abortion on demand that probably the state of Alabama has ever seen. And you have Roy Moore, who brings his own baggage, obviously. Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc., coming to you live from the studios of Lutheran Public Radio in Collinsville, Illinois. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. Pastor Hans Feeney is going to join us. He's written recently about the lesser of two evils and that Senate race in Alabama. We'll talk about 4th century Bishop Nicholas of Myra, who is a household name, St. Nicholas, of course, probably not in the same sense that he ought to be. Ironically, we know virtually nothing about the real Nicholas, but the church remembers him on the 6th of December. Pastor Joshua Hayes will join us to do the same here a little bit later. Then, Issues Etc., comment line, and listener email. We'll go through as much of it as we can on this Wednesday afternoon. You can join us with questions or comments. Our call-in number 1-877-623-6943. Send us an email, talkback@issuesetc.org. Send us a tweet at issuesetc or the Issues Etc. comment line 618-223-8382. Joining us to talk about the Alabama Senate race, candidate Roy Moore and the lesser of two evils, Pastor Hans Feeney, pastor of River of Life Lutheran Church in Shanahan, Illinois, creator of a series of comical videos called Lutheran Satire, and senior contributor to The Federalist, author of a recent column there titled, If Voting for Roy Moore is the Lesser of Two Evils, It's Still Evil. Hans, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thanks for having me.
So we had this massive debate, conversation nationally about the lesser of two evils voting during the 2016 presidential race. It's come up again with respect to the Alabama Senate race. Are you saying that conscientious voters can't vote for the lesser of two evils?
Well, I certainly think people should not vote for evil, in particular if there is an option not to vote for evil. And I think one of the challenges that we face, kind of from that ethical standpoint, is sort of wrestling with our philosophy and our understanding of what voting is, and especially in voting in a two-party system. So I guess the question is whether we accept the premise that one of these two people is going to win, and so you have to pick whichever of them is more tolerable, will do more good, and perhaps causes you to hold your nose the least, or do we accept the idea that your job in voting is just simply to vote for the person who best represents you, regardless of that person's chances of winning a general election? And that's certainly a debate I think that's worth having. I'm my philosophy on this is fairly simple, in that I'm not responsible for anybody else's vote, and I can only I can only take care of myself. And so there's an election between two people, both of whom I find to be unacceptable. If there's an election and the two main candidates are people that I find to be unacceptable for perhaps different reasons, I don't believe it's my responsibility to have to, I don't believe that I have to sort of lower my standards and embrace something that I think is wrong, and seek to give the position to someone to someone who I believe is where it would be a sin to do that. In particular, if I can cast my vote for someone that's that I don't believe is evil, and therefore it's not my responsibility what anybody else does in that matter.
Are we dealing in some cases here with a basic misunderstanding of the lesser of two evils scenario? I've seen it framed as, well, okay, Roy Moore is a terrible person, and his opponent is a terrible person, maybe more terrible, and plus I disagree with on moral principles with what he would probably accomplish as a senator in D.C. if elected. So I'm going to vote for Roy Moore, and the fact that he's less evil, in my estimation, and maybe could do some good in Washington, means that I'm not voting for evil at all.
Yeah, that's sort of an odd approach, and this is what I try to kind of address in the piece. I think oftentimes when we normally speak about a situation where you have to choose the lesser of two evils, what we're usually speaking about kind of ethically there is this idea that you have two choices in front of you that have kind of been foisted on you by the sinful world. So the sinful world has given two options before you, and you have to pick one, and there's not much that you can do about it. What I find to be irritating about this debate when it comes to politics is that, and when it comes to government, is, as I say in the piece, we are the government. So we are the ones responsible for the names that are on the ballot. We are the ones raising and bringing up people from our midst who seek to represent us. We are the ones who, our government is made of us. It's not some, you know, some alien civilization that's imposed upon us where we have to choose, you know, Kang or Kronos, which I think was the old Simpsons episode. But rather, we're responsible for the mess that we've created. So the reality is that if we do find ourselves in a situation where you need to choose the lesser of two evils in an election, I think we're failing to understand our own culpability in the matter if we sort of pat ourselves on the back for wisely and bravely choosing the lesser of two evils when it wouldn't have been a debate between the lesser of two evils if we had done the right thing in the first place.
What do you make of this argument that people who are, let's just take kind of a hypothetical Alabama voter who says, look, I want to see someone with Roy Moore's convictions about abortion and things like that in the U.S. Senate. I really do. But the things he's been accused of, if only half of them are true, I can't do it. And the accusation is leveled at such a voter. Well, you're just not willing to get your hands dirty.
Yeah, I think that's sort of an odd statement. And I think the great problem with that is that again, that statement sort of seems to presume that this is that this difficult situation is something else is not of our own creation. You know, as I say in the piece, that, you know, Moore didn't magically fall out of a Law and Order SVU episode and onto the Alabama ballot. The people there chose him. They had other options before them, and he was the one they wanted to represent the Republican Party in the election. So this sense that, oh, we all have to get our hands dirty, but we're going to pretend as though we're not the ones who created the dirt, strikes me as rather hypocritical. So yeah, the sense from people that they are the ones who have sort of the bravery and the honesty to acknowledge the situation for what it is, and as though other people are just simply living in some sort of fantasy land by virtue of the fact that they don't want to play along with this game, just strikes me as rather hypocritical when the people who are tossing that term out, you know, that you don't want to get your hands dirty, are the ones who simply refuse to get their own hands dirty by acknowledging that they're the ones who made the dirt.
Part of the context for this, Hans, is kind of the incredulity of the whole situation. How did we come to this situation where we have someone? Usually these revelations are made after someone served in the Senate for 50 years, like Conyers.
Right.
But this is even before the votes have been cast, and we've come to a situation where we're seriously being asked to, well, Alabamans are seriously being asked to vote or not vote for someone who, at the very least in the past, very serious, serious moral problems.
Yeah, I think apparently from studies I've seen about this recently, the vast majority of people who are planning on voting for Roy Moore say that they don't believe any of the allegations. And I suppose if you don't believe the allegations, if you're firmly convinced that this is just a media conspiracy to take down a Republican candidate, that's one thing. If you're genuinely convinced that the guy is not guilty and that these are all false allegations, there's not that same kind of moral quandary. However, that does sort of raise the question about, well, why are you drawing that conclusion? You know, I when I wrote the article, even though in the article I wasn't actually myself conceding that Roy Moore is guilty, I was just simply responding to an article that presumes his guilt, and so I was presuming his guilt as well in order to kind of dismantle that argument. But, you know, I've received a lot of interesting criticism from folks who were insisting that, oh, you know, there hasn't been any trial, and because there hasn't been any trial, we need to presume innocence, and we need to let due process take its course, and all of this. But of course, these are, you know, a lot of these are the same folks who, you know, who are chanting, you know, lock her up when it comes to Hillary Clinton, you know, for all of her supposed crimes against humanity, despite, you know, not having stood trial for any of those either. So there does seem to me to be a healthy degree of tribalism at play here, where we scream about due process and about giving people the benefit of the doubt and ensuring that people have had a right to a fair trial when we think that they're on our side. But when they're not on our side, of course, we already know that they're guilty, and we don't need a courtroom full of 12 jurors determining our views on the matter.
You use the term tribalism. You do it also in the Federalist piece. Just expand a little bit on what that context here is and what kind of a situation it creates.
Yeah, so I think the kind of political tribalism is sort of this idea that we each have our side, and our side is the good guys and the other guys are the bad guys. And in order to protect the tribe and in order to ensure the success of our tribe over and against the other tribe, that we're willing to embrace all sorts of things that we might criticize on the other side and adopt this kind of Machiavellian approach to elections and to government itself, where, you know, the ends justify the means, and whatever is necessary in order for us to accomplish the good that we want to accomplish is fine. So, you know, back in the 90s, when conservative Republicans weren't fond of the Clinton presidency and as he was running for president as well, there's these questions about, you know, his character, and conservatives wanted to make a big point about the fact that the character of a man is important when considering whether he's fit to lead a nation. And then all of a sudden, when you have men like Donald Trump and Roy Moore coming along, well, then we've sort of approached this utilitarian, we have this, adopted this utilitarian approach, where we're essentially saying, well, look, we're all sinners, and we're not electing a pastor in chief. We need to elect someone who's going to sign certain, you know, bills into law and things of that nature. And whether that man has the character to do so is really entirely secondary. So that's kind of how tribalism causes people to think, is it's just what's good for the goose is never good for the gander. And I think in particular what happens in situations like this is tribalism causes you to always see the other side as the enemy and always see yourself as the hero. And on account of this, when it comes to, again, sort of this question of judging between the lesser of two evils, therefore, if you have to choose between the lesser of two evils, you doing it is heroic, and you drawing the right conclusion is brave and virtuous. And so the only thing you have to do to draw the conclusion that you are good and virtuous is to conclude that your guy is the lesser of two evils. And so how do you do that? Well, you just end up kind of downplaying everything that the guy has done and saying, oh, these accusations don't really sound all that credible and things of that nature. You just interpret things through whatever lens makes your guy's evil seem not quite as bad as the other guy's, and then magically you become brave by virtue of the fact that you were able to muster up the strength and the courage to vote for the lesser evil.
Pastor Hans Feeney is our guest. We're talking about the Alabama Senate race, Roy Moore, and the lesser of evils on this Wednesday afternoon. When we come back, he's written extensively about what he calls outrage addiction. What role does that play in all of this? We'll answer that question after this.
Answering objections defending the faith, evolution or creation, transgenderism and homosexuality. These are some of the issues addressed at the San Antonio Biblical Worldview Conference, Saturday, February the 3rd at Faith Lutheran Church in San Antonio, Texas. Learn more at worldviewsa.org. This conference features issues that center a guest, Dr. Jan Lohmeyer and Pastor David J. Weber. The San Antonio Biblical Worldview Conference, Saturday, February the 3rd, worldviewsa.org.
Comfort, comfort, ye my people, for unto us a child is born, good news of great joy, the titles of Christ, the Magnificat. These are some of the Christmas card themes produced by Ad Crucem. Send a greeting card this Christmas season that's centered on the gospel of Jesus Christ. AdCrucem.com. Confessing the faith through art and word. AdCrucem.com. ADCRUCEM.com.
Where Christianity meets culture, you're listening to Issues, Etc.
So natural law is both outside of us and inside of us.
Aaron Wolf of Chronicles Magazine speaking at the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
God has written on the hearts of man his rules for right behavior. Man, in turn, can recognize these rules as he observes moral purposes in the design of the world around him. It is terribly crude to discuss it, but regarding homosexual activity, suffice it to say that nature itself teacheth the man that one of these things does not belong here.
You can listen to Aaron Wolf making the case for natural law on an audio DVD from both Issues Etc. Making the Case conferences. We'll send it to you for a year-end tax-deductible gift of $300. Two conferences on one DVD. Learn more at issuesetc.org and click on the conference audio DVD logo. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about the Alabama Senate race. Roy Moore and the Lesser of Two Evils, Pastor Hans Feeney, is our guest. The Lutheran Witness magazine interprets the contemporary world from a Lutheran perspective. A subscription to the Lutheran Witness would make a great Christmas gift for only $6.99. You can receive six digital or print issues. cph.org/try Lutheran Witness, cph.org/try Lutheran Witness. Hans, you have written about what you call outrage addiction. I think it's kind of a subset or a context for the tribalism you were discussing before. Take us back through that again.
Yeah, so outrage addiction is basically, it's kind of similar to the concept of anger addiction. And so essentially the idea being that your brain releases endorphins that make you feel good when you sort of lash out in anger at someone. And so that once people kind of get addicted to that, it becomes a sort of a physiological process where they're trying to actually feel good by getting angry at things. And so just like with any other drug addiction, you have to kind of manufacture things and you have to get access to the supply of the drug that you're trying to consume. And yeah, I think this does very much play along with tribalism, where when your drug of choice is getting angry at people on the other side of the political aisle, what outrage addiction does is it causes you to simply take everything out of context that people from the other side say, to read everything in the worst possible light, to make their enemies and their bad guys so much worse than your own bad guys, so that you can just simply lash out in anger at them and therefore get that sense of euphoria that you're trying to unlock in your brain.
I wanted you to kind of offer your thoughts on something I saw earlier. Of course, the blood in the water today is that Senator Conyers has announced that instead of just running out his term, he's going to resign.
Right.
And there are allegations, apparently credible allegations against him going back years and years. If the chatter is to be believed, then Al Franken is going to announce that he resigns tomorrow. those are two legislators there. And the take I saw on it was Democrats claim moral high ground or take moral high ground. But it strikes me that it's not so much moral as political high ground. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose if you look at the timing of things, I think on the one hand, there's kind of two ways to look at this, which is that politicians respond to the desires of their constituents, and they know that if they don't support things that their constituents greatly support, that they will get voted out of office, which is sort of the hope is that in the end they end up doing something somewhere along the realm of the right thing. So I think there's obviously been a lot of justifiable outrage when people hear about the accusations against these politicians. And so there's a desire to see them pay some sort of price in terms of removing themselves from the positions that they are in and from public life in that regard. But there's sometimes a little bit of a slow response in government itself. You know, I think the seventh allegation against Al Franken that came out today that seemed to have been the straw that broke the camel's back, with a bunch of senators now calling for his resignation. But I think there is, too, you can sort of look at things and you say, all right, well, the Democrats are doing the right thing, but on the one hand, there is sort of a sense of political expedience to it, you know. So John Conyers is not in a district that is going to be in danger of going to a Republican, and for it apparently seems as though he's more or less going to be handing the seat over to his son. Likewise, Al Franken's the governor of Minnesota is a Democrat who is most certainly going to appoint a Democrat to fill that vacant position for the rest of the term. So the Democrats aren't necessarily in danger of losing any political power by these men stepping down, whereas obviously, there's that sort of that question of, well, if Republicans don't back Roy Moore, will that actually cause them a Senate seat? Which I think is a fair question to raise, even while it's good, you know, if the outcome is that men who have done things that ought to disqualify them from public service are therefore stepping down from public service, and that's certainly a good thing for constituents to expect their representatives to demand.
I think we've also seen a little contrast, and I wonder if Christians in particular can derive some kind of insight from it, and that is the willingness or unwillingness of the various, and this is largely men we're talking about, men in the media, out of the media, to simply say, yep, I did those things, or to dig in and say, as Roy Moore is apparently doing, nope, none of it's true. What do we learn there?
Well, I think, yeah, the response in all of these things has been rather odd to me, where it's not only just in politics, but as well as other figures as well, where men have come out and have basically said, well, my kind of recollection of that event was a little bit different, but I'm very sorry that that this woman felt this way, and I'll really be kind of thinking about this going forward, and, you know, sort of using this as an opportunity to better myself and whatnot. And which I suppose makes the Roy Moore response a little bit different, because he's, for the most part now, is at least locked in and saying that he didn't do these things, that he didn't even know these women, despite earlier on basically saying, well, yeah, I may have dated that girl when she was a teenager and things, but I don't really recall, and things of that nature. And I think what we ought to learn from that is that, you know, I think this is kind of one of the challenges of these situations is, we want, obviously, people who have been victimized to feel confident that if they come forward, they're going to be believed and they're not going to have their names dragged through the mud. But at the same time, we also need to have some measure of guarding against false allegations, because lives can very easily be destroyed with those, too. And so I think what we ought to learn from these situations is, if you are in fact guilty of these things, offer up a real apology and ask for actual real forgiveness. And if you are not guilty of these things and these are completely false allegations and total fabrications against you, then you ought not to concede that you've done these things or give some measure of making people think that you are guilty of something that you haven't done, and rather ought to call people who are lying about you to repentance. So I think that's one of the lessons to take away from all of this.
One thing that we've talked a lot about this here in the office, and the question that has been brought up again and again and again, and this really just requires a pastoral response, and that is, how does, again, this is largely men, how does a man get himself to this place where, in the case of Franken's, if his accusers are to be believed, just regularly groped women while having photographs with them? or in the case of the others who, say, Charlie Rose, who just made it kind of a routine to act inappropriately in flagrant ways around women who worked for him. The question we've been rolling around is, how do you get to the point where you think you're allowed to do that kind of stuff? As a pastor, how do you respond to that?
Well, I think one of the great struggles is that in the years and decades since the sexual revolution, there has, you know, a lot of men have kind of grown up with this mindset, and a lot of people have been instilled with this mindset that sex is ultimately for seeking pleasure, and it's not connected with honoring that other person with commitment, and ultimately with marriage. And so when people kind of have this mindset that that basically they have the right to pursue pleasure and that they are in essence entitled to another person's body, and that the only thing that would stop them from being entitled to another person's body is a lack of consent, well, the great problem with that sexual worldview is that consent is determined by the powerful and those who are chasing pleasure. And if they have the power to impose themselves on those who are weaker than they are in a given situation, if they have the ability to set another bar for what consent is, and one that doesn't, that the other person wouldn't agree with, they will very oftentimes do that. And I think the great thing for us to remember in all of this is that our sinful nature will seize any and every opportunity to embrace just kind of sexual anarchy really of any kind, but certainly sexual anarchy in that regard. And the more boundaries that we set for ourselves, the more we restrain ourselves, the more that we prevent our sinful nature from not just from overpowering us and doing something that we ought not do, but from corrupting the very way that we think about people. And so it's not just that in moments of weakness that men behave this way, but for certain men it's that it becomes the way that they think. And the more boundaries that we have for ourselves, the more that we insist on not placing ourselves in positions where we're able to do that, the more we're able to prevent our minds from kind of rewiring themselves and coming to embrace an evil way of thinking.
Finally, then, with about 30 seconds, how do you respond to someone who says, look, the Alabama voter is not being asked to choose a pastor, just a senator. So if that's the case, you just vote for the person who's going to represent your views.
Yeah, I think we have plenty of biblical evidence that God does, in fact, expect secular authorities and earthly rulers to be righteous people. It's not just the unfaithful priests who get words of prophetic condemnation in the scriptures, but also the kings of Israel and also the kings of all the earth. So this notion that, well, we're not electing a pastor for this position, we got to disavow ourselves of this notion that God somehow has lower moral expectations of secular leaders than he does of clergy. And ultimately, what we ought to say in that matter is that understanding the boundaries between the secular and the sacred, and understanding the two kingdoms, we're not going to come to a proper conclusion on what the role of the state is if we're using that distinction to justify voting for people that we would have condemned the other political side from voting for five seconds ago.
Pastor Hans Feeney is pastor of River of Life Lutheran Church in Shanahan, Illinois, creator of a series of comical videos called Lutheran Satire. He is senior contributor to The Federalist and author of a recent column there, titled, If Voting for Roy Moore is the Lesser of Two Evils, It's Still Evil. You can read it and learn more about Lutheran satire at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Hans, thank you very much.
Thank you.
On the other side of the break, we're going to be talking about 4th century Bishop Nicholas of Myra. He is the St. Nicholas that everybody, well, thinks they're talking about. He's a household name, but how much do we actually know about the real Nicholas of Myra? The church remembers him on this day, and we will do so as well with Pastor Joshua Hayes. Then it's listener email and the Issues Etc. comment line for the remainder of the program.
We would like to overlook the difficulty of daily repentance and death to our sins in the interest of progressing to a more advanced spirituality.
Rebecca Curtis from her new audiobook, Ladylike, Living Biblically.
Somehow, spiritual advancement always amounts to our getting to spend more time on the things we like and calling it stewardship or service.
You can purchase and download an audio version of Ladylike, Living Biblically at Amazon, Audible, and iTunes. Ladylike, Living Biblically by Rebecca Curtis and Rose Adel.
Many Lutheran pastors outside of the U.S. receive little or no seminary education. Luther Academy provides theological triage through conferences, books, and journals. Help support Luther Academy by making a tax-deductible donation at lutheracademy.com or call 260-452-2211. Serving Lutheran pastors to the ends of the earth, Luther Academy, 260-452-2211 or lutheracademy.com.
No gimmicks, no shticks. Just straightforward preaching and teaching in accord with Scripture and the Lutheran confessions. By the book liturgy, right from the hymnal. No glitz, just Christ crucified for sinners like us. We're Grace Lutheran Church in Racine, Wisconsin. Come receive God's gifts with us. Find out more about us at gracelutheranracine, that's all one word, .net. And like you, we're proud supporters of Issues, etc.
This year, keep Christ at the center of your holiday reading list with the Lutheran Witness magazine. Enjoy articles on the Virgin Mary, family Advent activities, candlelight services, and more. The December issue even includes a special Christmas gift guide for Lutherans. Visit cph.org/witness to start or renew your subscription or to purchase a gift subscription for a loved one this Christmas. The Lutheran Witness, interpreting the contemporary world from a Lutheran perspective.
Smartest listeners in radio, you're listening to Issues, Etc.
For 28 years, I had the privilege of serving as a chaplain in the United States Navy.
Dr. Dan Gard, retired Rear Admiral and President of Concordia University Chicago, on the need for military chaplains.
During that time, I was able to bring word and sacrament to so many young people and their families, our sons and daughters spread throughout the world. Truly a privilege and an honor. And today, there are other chaplains that must follow. We need more LCMS chaplains in all branches of the military. It's an incredible, amazing mission opportunities to go to places no other pastor can go, but to go with the same tools that any other pastor brings wherever he goes, word and sacrament.
You can find out more about the vocation of military chaplain at lcms.org/armedforces. The LCMS ministry to the armed forces, lcms.org/armedforces.